I put this picture up just to show the female part of the audience what they're missing, because Pierre is really a cute kid, and I'm not. So this is to explain the big part of his thesis work, actually. And that's the basis. Hold on a second. I didn't get it right here. How am I get to advance it?
Yeah, if you left click on the mouse, it'll advance it. Yeah, left click right here.
Oh, no. There sure, that's stupid. Okay. One of the beginning points is we want to understand what plants are trying to do in order to control their environment. Now, this is really an ecologist's view of the world. And I was very surprised when I started to work with Pierre, because he was an ecologist by training. And in fact, ecologists are very anthropomorphic kind of things. Everything is, it's thinking. You know, what is the strategy of a plant? What is the strategy of this? What is the strategy of that? Because in fact, their point of entry into the complex world is how things interact. So that if they do interact, there must be sort of a reason for it and so forth. So in fact, it's sort of an amusing thought, and I think it's somewhat true, is that most plant life started in the ocean, as we know. And the ocean is full of sodium because it's salty. And in fact, the reason that the ocean is full of sodium is that the potassium, to a large extent, as far as the alkalis are concerned, the potassium is held by clay minerals to a certain extent. And in fact, to a large extent, many times. So plants came out the ocean along the edges, and there was still a lot of sodium around. And there are some measurements that have been made on perimaritime plants where you can see a change in the sodium-potassium ratio in the same species as a function of more or less of its distance from sodium, high sodium waters, so that they can adapt even within the species. So these plants started up, and they looked around, and it seems that they need sodium or potassium, an alkali, for their physiology. Very, very much. In fact, more and more probably on the surface, because it basically controls the stomata and the intake and the flow of gases, things like that. But neither the sodium nor the potassium seems to be fixed in the organic molecules. It's something that is adjacent to it, but it's not an intimate part of a complex organic compound. So these plants started out, and they looked around, and they said, oh, geez, there's no sodium here. We got to do something. So they adapted themselves and took the other alkali, which seems to function as well, which is potassium. Then they moved up and onto the surface of the earth, and they used potassium instead of sodium. So they were adapting, and their strategy then was to maintain the sources of potassium, which in fact are inevitably going to be taken out. So that they were adapting. But then the smart people with minds, we can think, we are sodium dependent. That is, animals, if you put potassium in their veins, they die. You know, they didn't adapt. So plants that were adapted in animals, things that can move around, can search for their needs, didn't make this adaptive process. So that the plants are going to try to, in fact, control the environment as much as possible so that they can maintain themselves within a local area, which is where they will be placed and not be able to move along. So the idea is one of, if I can see this, yep, there we are, of how this thing functions. And therefore, we can get an idea of what it's going to be doing. Yeah. So actually, the plants, as was mentioned yesterday, it is well known, take materials from depth and they bring them up into the tree. Some of it goes down into the roots, but very much of it makes a cycle this way and it comes down onto the surface. So that this input can be more or less important depending upon the needs of the plants, whereas they're recycling things here. There's always going to be a loss of any element at the surface through rainfall and I'm not very good at that. Through rainfall and loss in the water that's going across the surfaces and down underneath. So there are many elements that are put in. Potassium, we know of silicon, which was talked about yesterday, the phytoliths, calcium, magnesium, and other things of this sort. So these have all been very well known. And the phytolith thing, I think, is really fascinating because we've known about phytoliths a long time. And as far as anybody can determine, for most plants, they have no structural use or importance. In some grasses, it seems that they form a sort of network in the stem that helps reinforce the rigidity of it. But for the largest part, they're independent nodules of silica, which is highly, highly reactive form of silica at the surface. So the system is one of recycling as much as possible and maintaining a continued flow and availability of particular nutrients, potassium, for this plant. Is this true? Well, if we hadn't found some evidence, we wouldn't be talking about it in a way. So basically, what was striking to me is that if you look at the data in soil sequences, which people have published very much and frequently not commented very much on, we find that very frequently, for example, in the clay fraction in the sandy soil in grasslands, we find that at the surface in the A horizon, sometimes the E or whatever it is, we find a kick over here where there's more potassium present at the surface. So potassium is an element that is easily dissolved. It can be washed out, supposedly. At the surface, we should be having the highest amount of rainfall unsaturated solutions. We would expect that up here we would be losing this potassium, and maybe it would be more important at depth, which is sort of the case for the coarse grain materials. But the clay fractions, we see that it seems to be stabilized. This is a series of a time series, in a way, of alpine soils developed on moraines where you can date them more or less. And we see that in the, where are we? The potassium in the A horizon decreases some and more or less stabilizes. But in the B horizon, down deeper, we continue to lose it and continue to lose it. And so you say, well, there's something going on here, and it must be the effects at the surface, which is where the plants, in fact, are. Parallel, we find that in the A horizon, the silica actually is stabilized right away, and we're losing it down below by chemical transformation of the minerals that are present. But here, it's being stabilized. So what's going on? Well, the plants want potassium. They need this alkali. And the potassium, the alkali, is in fact sequestered to a certain extent or fixed upon clay minerals. Everybody more or less should know that in any event. But these clay minerals are the 2-to-1 clay minerals, which are the most silica-rich clay minerals that we know. What we can call illite or mica, then kaolinite, then gibbsite. We're losing silica in this direction, and in this direction, we're increasing the potassium content. So the normal chemical alteration, the normal process of dissolution and transport of dissolved elements in solution is going this way. High silica content, high alkali content minerals going down here. So what do the plants do? They bring from depth below the surface area where they're stocking things in a way, where the minerals are being altered down below, they bring from depth the alteration elements that are going into solution, silica and potassium, and they bring the system back up by the addition of chemical materials at the surface to stabilize 2-to-1 minerals such as smectite and illite. So they figured out the chemistry that Hal Helgerson did in a number of years ago. And these plants have been doing it for hundreds of millions of years. They knew what they were, how to stabilize these things. It's a normal chemical solution chemistry process. So now, it's okay, there aren't too many young people here, so I won't contaminate them. But this is a sort of a heretical approach to clay mineralogy. This is our system where we're bringing up silica and potassium to the surface, and we're stabilizing the 2-to-1 minerals here at the surface. But actually, these 2-to-1 minerals, it's Wonder Bread. You got this sheet of 2-to-1, this sheet of 2-to-1. There's a charge on the surface that depends upon the mineral. It can be changed clearly by oxidation or reduction within that layer. But the charge is on the surface, and we have compensating ions that are in between the layers. They can be, as we saw before, ALOH, they can be potassium, they can be hydrated cations, which we call exchangeable cations or base exchangeable cations. So actually, this is a sandwich. So the names that we give to clay minerals are really based, for the most part, on this interlayer material. But this interlayer material is subject to the importance of the chemical potentials outside in the solutions. And this is how you get polymerized, which is the chlorite is a polymerization and a structuring of ALOH, which is neutral, whereas the vermiculite or the hydroxy interlayered ions, they are an ion. It's ALOH2 plus 1. So if you neutralize that, then it polymerizes and you close the layer. One can assume that it can go the other way around also. You can extract it. Most processes are reversible. So you can put it in, you can take it out. And so who are the guys that are controlling the chemistry? The plants. Okay, so in order to quantify, if we can use that term, or at least get a better idea of how much material is present, and as Chris showed this just before, one of the recent methods of determining, in fact, the elements, the minerals that are present, is taking a model of peak shape and position and trying to fit the numerous phases that are present to account for this envelope of diffraction intensity. In the old days, when I started out, which was really pretty far ago, a long time, we'd look at a spectrum, here's a phase here, and here's a phase here, and all this fuzzy stuff. Well, we couldn't say too much what it was, but it was probably so far and so on. So we would, in fact, be identifying two major phases. But, in fact, this peak here is just due to a little intensity that is superimposed upon a very large peak, and you can guess it when you look at it here. Whereas this peak here is very intense, and it's a phase, it's very strongly present. So the idea that we had was to try to follow the importance of the clay mineral transformations affected by plants or by agricultural processes using these methods, but looking at the phases that in fact contain potassium. So the hydroxychloride or whatever it is, doesn't contain much potassium or hardly any. Whereas here we have typically in soils an illite smectite mineral, but that is smectite rich, very much smectite. The second one, which I would call really a soil clay, which doesn't occur in diagenetic sequences at all. Temperature goes up, this phase is not stable. It's an illite rich illite smectite. So basically we have two phases that are present in the soils, and we have two forms of small crystallite size and a well-crystallized size of illite. These don't change by glycolation or whatever, whereas these change their position by glycol treatment, so forth and so on. Now, there's one thing that I would like to harp on, and this is don't mess around with your clays. Most chemical treatments will transform the clays somewhat and give you a different answer from what you've seen in the beginning. And this mixed layered mineral is a very classical, or could be a classical case. These two minerals are randomly stratified mixed layered minerals in the soil. One is Illite-rich, and this one is smectite-rich. And they're sufficiently separated so that you can see them almost all the time. And in fact, in Chris's spectra, he found them. And you weren't really looking for them either. Okay. So basically, these things, if you glycolate them, they're both disordered. They both find the same position at 17 angstroms. They're superposed. So glycol treatment, in fact, destroys the distinction between these two. And as it turns out, if you potassium saturate the solution with just a small amount, 0.001, this peak will be shifting over dramatically, and in fact will increase the intensity. You get some shift of this one into the illite-shaped peak. So that not treating is extremely important. Another point, I think, that's without the treatments, you can see that this peak here, which is the HI or the chlorite, is a very narrow peak. So when you fit and you have a narrow peak, a peak that's about less than half a degree in width, you can just say, okay, this is one of these hydroxy interlayered minerals. Its position will be 14.2 angstroms, and the smectites will be further out or in that range, but they will be much wider. So when you glycolate, this moves away and you see this one remain. So you don't really need to glycolate. Heresy. So using these tools, modern tools, and it wasn't easy to get this kind of information when you didn't have it, which wasn't all that long ago, 10 years ago or so. Using these new tools, we looked at time sequences where my fieldwork expenses are low, which is in France, and you don't have to go very far to the polder salt marshes in the Somme Bay, which is just across from England. We looked at the poldered sequences, which are similar to those in Holland, which have been poldered for 700 years. The sea is, sedimentation rate is increasing. The sea level is not particularly involved. We're getting more and more materials being deposited. And in fact, the salt marshes are extending out into the channel. The starting materials are illite rich. They're coming from the soils, top soils, in fact, from England and from France to a large extent. This gets deposited, and with time, this is 1968, the oldest polder was 11,058. There were monks out there digging and, you know, singing and things like that and planting wheat. And in fact, most of this material here, there was very little agriculture as such. It was mostly grazing. So they created artificial prairies. In the artificial prairie, the prairie materials, in fact, maintained this illitic component, which is basically the same as a function of time. But when you get below the rich zone area, you see that the smectites, the big smectite-rich materials, become more and more important, in particularly up here, at the interface where there's a lot of unsaturated water that's coming in, and you're creating a new mineral, which is due to normal water-rock interaction change. So the prairies are stabilizing the illite at the surface, and down below we're losing this illite content. So if we look at the increase in importance in this mineral as a function of time, we have a curve. It's in the form of S. Now, an S-shaped curve, time and material, some kind of transition or whatever you're measuring, is a function of time. This is the signature of biologic action. Normal chemical driven reactions have a C-shaped curve. Have a C-shaped curve that goes up like this and then comes across. You don't have this period of latence when the reaction doesn't take off fast. So we can use this to say, okay, the natural situation whereby normally we should have a stable plant-driven system is with illite at the surface. So as was said yesterday, the prairie plants are high phytolith content materials. So they're stabilizing the 2-to-1 minerals in the humic horizon very highly. And then this can capture the potassium that's brought up from depth and sequester it to a certain extent and keep it available for future growth. So that's the natural system. Now, in another part of France, they used the same technique. They poldered, but in fact, it was agriculture. Instead of being the natural prairie, they were farming it with wheat and other products. I don't know exactly what. More recently, this is 1912. We have more recent ones where they started to plant corn. We haven't really seen the effects yet. So what is the effect when man was using this material and using it as an agricultural resource with a classical system of agriculture, using animal fertilizer and crop rotation systems and so forth and so on? Here we find that for all of the minerals, there is an increase in the smectitic, in the illitic mixed layered minerals, and in the illite itself. We're getting an increase, in fact, of illite in the different phases that are present. So this means that the traditional farming practices for traditional French people were conservative. They were not exhausting the soils very much. No, it's okay. Now, let's go back to where I come from, Illinois, where we raise corn, and classically we crop rotated some, but then decided, well, it wasn't too important. Now, this is these are the moral plots where they did comparative studies. These things exist in most of the Midwest universities and other places, such as in Kentucky, so forth, and so on, different kind of treatments. But here, the experiment was to say, okay, let's just put corn, continuous corn, CC. Here is continuous corn from 1913 until 96, and see what happens. No fertilizers or whatever. Here we can see the normal clays that were present when they started out. A lot of illite here, and the smectitic illite smectite position was 13.5. And at the end of the experiment, the illite content, which is this peak is 10.7 and a 10, is greatly decreased. We're creating more of this illite-rich mixed layered mineral, but losing a significant portion of illite layers. So this content decreases significantly. And in fact, the mixed layered mineral is shifting towards an illite-poor mineral. So in this case, we're losing potassium from each of the different phases. Whereas by conservative, regenerative farming practices, such as those in the polder on the west coast of France, we were in fact increasing it. So you can go one way or the other, as one would suspect. And this is just looking at the potassium content and the illite content, and there's a reasonable correlation, which means that our curve decomposition method isn't so bad. Now, Pierre looked at some samples. As you can see, it's a younger generation, they use colors. Where I don't mean that stuff. Anyway, this is on which were plots 50 years using different fertilization techniques, different amounts of potassium, and in continuing this for this long period of time. So no K fertilization, 200 kilograms, so forth and so on. Here, we want to look at the illite content of potassium so we don't decompose the vermiculite peak or the soil chloride peak. We're just going to look at these four here. And you can see intuitively that there's a difference, of course, at the beginning. And Pierre likes to do statistics. So he plotted up, if you take each of the peaks and it has a certain amount of 10 angstrom material present, you can calculate the center of gravity of these peaks, that is the surface area and the amount of illite present, its position. And you can calculate the center of gravity or relatively how much illite layer is present in the soil mineral sequence where you have different phases present that contain the potassium and illite layers. So he got a pretty good relationship between the center of gravity, which is decreasing, going towards Illite, and the amount of potassium that remains on. We put potassium on the surface, and then some of it's coming off by the plants, and so you calculate the amount that remains, and he likes that nice correlation coefficient. So we can use the X-ray diffraction method to estimate with reasonable precision, really, the effects of treatment of the soils by different agricultural methods. And another way is to take, in fact, measure the potassium in the clay fraction and the center of gravity, which is looking at all of the different contents of potassium layers that are there. And the correlation is a little bit less impressive, but there are many more points, so that's one of the things. But it just, the idea is that we can use this X-ray diffraction doing the curve decomposition to follow the changes that are affected by different agricultural practices as the plants and the fertilizers affect the basic reserves of potassium in the soils. So, conclusions are what they are. But I think it's very interesting that now we have tools that, in fact, can really assess quantitatively, to a certain extent, how much these things affect the soil resources. And the last ones, before it was several centuries, we were looking at this. The last series was 50 years. And in fact, some very recent information that I have now, which has not been published, of course, indicates that we can, in fact, follow the change of potassium reserves in the clays in the soils over 1 year growing period. So we're getting into real time to be able to assess the effect of what the treatments are and what we're using as agricultural practice at the surface, so that there's a sufficient and quick enough feedback so that, in fact, you can appoint somebody to the Secretary of Agriculture and he decides this is a new program, and before he's out of office, you can see whether it's working or not. You don't have to say, well, you wait 400 years and you'll see if you're right or not. But these things go very, very quickly. But that's the other part of it, is that the plant-soil interaction, the mineral and bio interactions are really extremely rapid because we're just looking at this interlayer position, which is a sandwich. Illite is ham, HI is cheese sandwich, and then is jelly for the smectite. Those things could go in and out, and the chemistry is being controlled by the plants. Thank you. It's not too bad.
Any questions for Bruce?
Silica?
Yeah.
It's taken up by the roots. It's dissolved silica in the zones where you're getting basic mineral transformation from the bedrock. So there's a certain
amount. Silica is not a nutrient. I mean, the plants absorb silica as a laboratory consumption, or what is the negative?
Well, it goes. It's a dissolved species, the same as potassium. It's an ionic dissolved species. It goes into the system. It gets moved up, and it gets precipitated in the plant. But it doesn't. It's not functional in the biology of the plant itself. But it is functional in stabilizing the 2-to-1 minerals in the soil.
What happened in the desilication process, which is a dominant process of soil formation?
What happens?
These
phytolites are extremely soluble. They're extremely reactive. To a large extent, they dissolve in the rainwater. But this material is active in solution, and so it's the solution chemistry that stabilizes the smectites.
So that, in fact, there are cases in which have been demonstrated in the Brazilian forests where at the surface, kaolinite is being gibbsite is being transformed into kaolinite. And enough of this highly active material so that it's, in fact, creating new minerals. So in our areas where 2-to-1 minerals are dominant in much of the temperate areas, they're probably just stabilizing it, avoiding that they be dissolved. They're not becoming unstable. Whereas deeper down, they can become unstable.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank you again.